comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks. Welcome to the show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous planet. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. It's talk radio like nowhere else on earth, and it's the show where you really do matter. I found something kind of interesting in the news, and actually several days ago, I've been holding this back for an appropriate time where it would fit in with what we were doing, and I really can't find an appropriate time where it really fits in with what we're doing, but it's very, very interesting. Because, you know, very often on this show, I have said, look, I'm not a religious person. And some people, of course, they can't imagine that, you know, if you say you're not religious, then that means you're an atheist. That's because they have not yet been able to think beyond religion. They've not yet been able to separate that in their minds that there is God, and then there's this man-made stuff called religion. That's supposed to somehow get you closer to God or whatever. Well, America is really not a very religious place. The United States of America is not a very religious place. Church membership numbers are pretty high. Church attendance numbers are pretty low. And they continue to sink. And, of course, there are some mega churches, but overall, the country is not a very religious country. And yet, it is a spiritual country, but to a surprising degree. Scott Schliemann, a sociology professor at the University of Toronto, examined data from two recent national surveys of Americans and their beliefs about God's involvement in their everyday lives. And then the results were published in the March issue of the Journal of Sociology of Religion. And I thought it was pretty interesting because when people were asked if they depend on God for help and guidance in making decisions, I would have thought the number would be much lower than it is. Do you have any idea? It's pretty amazing. Do you have any? What percentage of Americans said, yes, I depend upon God for guidance in making decisions? What percentage would you think? 45%, 50%, 60%, 65%, 82%, 82%. So what that tells you is that there are lots of folks that are spiritual, but if you compare that to how many are religious, the number that are religious is shrinking. But the number who are spiritual has not shrunk. 82%. Thought that was interesting. It does have something to do with tonight's show. And we're going to be talking about fiction and physics. Don't go away. My guest this evening is Chet Sapalio, and he is a physicist and a philosopher. He was trained at the University of Pittsburgh and then at Pennsylvania State University. His research has focused on alternative propulsion methods, including warp drive, wormhole creation, quantum tunneling, dimensional shifting, and time travel. He also, in 1999, produced a documentary for television called Conspiracy X, Government Secrets Revealed, after living in Roswell, New Mexico for 2 years and researching the 1947 Roswell incident. Chet Sapalio, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted to have you.
Good evening, Kevin. It's a real pleasure to be with you tonight, along with your listening audience.
Chet, in addition to being a physicist and a philosopher, you also are now a novelist, and it's pretty interesting what you've done. Folks, he's written a book called Sworn to Secrecy, The 1947 Roswell Incident. And what Mr. Sapalio has done is he has taken some real facts of history, a really strange event that we're all familiar with, and has taken those facts and woven them into the pages of a novel so that you run across fact and you run across fiction woven in with the fact. It's like taking the facts and creating a to me, it looks like a perfect screenplay for a movie. Chet, tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, Kevin, thank you for the great introduction and the kind words. The historical novel focuses on real military and political characters that took part in the event, and it weaves a saga about how their participation in this historical event affected their personal and professional lives. The main character of the book is Colonel Butch Blanchard, a real authentic guy that headed up the 509th there in Roswell, New Mexico. Actually, the first atomic bomb group, the only atomic bomb group at that time, the group that actually dropped the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The reason that Butch is the main character of the novel and the primary goal of the novel is to drive home the point that somebody like Colonel Blanchard, who was eventually promoted to Deputy Joint Chiefs and probably would have become a Joint Chief of Staff if he hadn't died of a massive coronary in 1965, it explains how somebody so promotable and such a strong military guy, how in fact he could have made a mistake, as the government and the military said at the time, how he could have made a mistake and thought that a weather balloon was in fact a craft of unknown origin. So the book primarily talks about Butch's life and how he climbed through the ranks and how he dealt with the massive cover-up.
You know, now the facts of his life, the real life story of Colonel Blanchard, have always been one of the, in my opinion, one of the greatest evidences that the story about the weather balloon was fake, because he was promotable, and I think would not have been had that actually been a mistake. And, you know, he was promotable because it wasn't a mistake and because he participated in the cover-up. And I've also made the point that you had the top air intelligence officer on the planet in Jesse Marcel. He was the air intelligence officer for the only atomic armed wing on the planet. And how could he have mistaken what he saw? How could that be a weather balloon and this guy not know it? I mean, the whole thing just flies in the face of reality. But what you've done is you've kind of taken that whole issue of the fact that he was promotable, and you've woven it into the pages of your novel. Now, in your novel, Colonel Blanchard actually sees a UFO, right, while he's flying.
He does. In the novel, he's flying with left seat, actually, with Pappy Henderson, the gentleman that in real life was noted for taking the alien bodies to Wright Patterson after the event. But in the novel, it starts that while flying a nuclear bomb training mission, actually over Santa Fe, near the Corona Ranch area, Butch Blanchard witnesses an object traveling at an impossible speed that almost collides with his plane. And later on in the book, the craft is seen crashing in the high desert there north of Roswell. And Butch is placed in charge of the crash recovery and cleanup, where five humanoid bodies are discovered near the crash site. And Butch is suddenly dealing with alien autopsies and alien technology and becomes entangled in a massive government cover-up.
All right, now you served, when you were living in New Mexico, you served on the board of directors for the International UFO Museum in Roswell. That would mean that you had access to lots and lots of information. Let me ask you, because you are a physicist as well as a novelist, that means you're a scientist. You think in terms that are pretty much feet on the ground terms, scientific terms. After looking at all the evidence that surrounds you in that museum, did you come to any conclusions about the Roswell crash as to whether it was actually an alien craft? Yes or no? What conclusions did you come to, if any?
Well, there's certainly a number of different theories. It might have been something that was left over from the Nazi regime. It might have been a craft that the Russian or the Soviets might have been trying to develop. But after talking to the number of people that I talked to, and it wasn't just people from Roswell that were either directly or indirectly involved with the craft, but it was researchers from all over the world that spent some time in the Roswell area researching, I became thoroughly convinced that it was a craft of unknown origin, probably a craft of extraterrestrial origin. You know, there are many theories out there that maybe we're not the only intelligence that occupies the Earth, and maybe there is an intelligence that occupies the Earth that's much more advanced, in fact, than the human species. But my personal belief is that it was extraterrestrial in origin. You know, our universe contains more stars than there are grains of sand on the beaches of the entire Earth. And planets in the universe, probably some very similar to our own, that orbit some of these stars. You know, as recent astronomical evidence indicates. So my years of research have led me to believe that we are being visited by alien intelligences and have been for probably a very long time. The main question, Kevin, that sparks my interest in UFO research has always been this, that given the vast distances between stars and galaxies and the universal speed limit that Einstein put forward in his special theory of relativity, even at that tremendous speed, how do UFOs get here? What form of propulsion are they using? Is it based on undiscovered physics or underdeveloped technology? Just what technology are the aliens using? So it was that question that motivated me in my career to investigate the UFO phenomenon. And the work done at Roswell just tended to confirm my thinking.
I'm very glad you brought up Einstein's universal speed limit. That's the speed of light.
That's correct.
You and I have already had some conversations about that, and you know I don't buy it.
Yeah. We have had a few interesting discussions about that, yes.
All right, now, let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
Because I'm going to propose in very elementary form a theory, or at least a hypothesis, and in very elementary form, an equation. It would take a physicist who is a philosopher to work it out. But I'm going to throw it out there, and I'll let you decide whether you want to cook it or not. All right, so here it is. And my audience already knows this. The speed of light, from my point of view, is not the fastest speed there is. It is the fastest speed we can observe. Now, the reason I say that is because it's quite obvious, and a great many physicists and astronomers now say that space, that the universe, is expanding faster than the speed of light. Now, if it weren't, then we should see reflection of light coming off the edges of the universe. We ought to be able to find the edge of the universe. But we can't. And the reason we can't is because it's expanding faster than light. Now, Einstein was really concerned and focused on what if you ran right alongside a beam of light so that you were traveling at the same speed as that beam of light, what would you observe? What would it be like? Well, I go a step beyond. Let's say we go 1 millisecond faster than that speed. What would you observe? Well, you would observe nothing, because when you go 1 millisecond faster than the speed of light, you have entered the speed of dark. You have outrun light. The universe is the natural state of the universe is dark. So the speed of light, while it is a speed that we think is enormous, and we would love to get up to that speed, may in fact be one of the slowest speeds in the universe.
Well, Kevin, you present an interesting hypothesis, and the first comment that comes to mind is that physicists, in fact, have theorized the existence of the tachyon, and the tachyon is a particle that goes faster than the speed of light. And, you know, it certainly may exist. I don't think that we've detected any yet, but there are theories that allow for it. The difficulty is this. If something exists naturally at less than the speed of light, the energy necessary to accelerate it to the speed of light grows with velocity. So the faster it goes, the more massive it becomes. And the more massive it becomes, the more energy that's required to accelerate it faster. And the special theory of relativity equations, actually very simple equations, they're algebraic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
They've got this thing in the denominator and that says that when you exceed or when you reach C, that denominator, the speed of light C, that denominator becomes zero. And anything divided by zero gives us infinity as an answer. And so the necessary energy to accelerate something that's moving at less than the speed of light originally requires an infinite amount of energy to exceed the speed of light.
All right. I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about E equals MC squared. And let's spell out what each of those are. E is energy, equals M, mass. And what is C?
C is the speed of light.
Squared. How can you square something that is the infinite speed limit?
Well, you just, in fact, multiply the speed of light in meters per second squared times itself.
Okay, but the point is that you're depending in that equation upon something which his theory says doesn't exist. And if he...
I understand.
Yeah. So if so what I'm saying is that the theory depends upon something that the theory attempts to prove doesn't exist. Now, there is speed faster than the speed of light. We can't observe it with our eyes, but instruments can, and we can observe the instruments. There is a pulsar that is undergoing magnetic polarity changes, shifts. North becomes south, south becomes north, and it's doing it at six times the speed of light. Now, let me just push this just one little step further.
Please.
Provided that you could go 1 millisecond faster than the speed of light, which in fact, in order for the theory to actually exist, it depends upon being able to square the speed of light. All right, now, if you could go 1 millisecond faster, you would be outrunning light. You would then be in darkness. Dark is faster than light because of that. All right, now, there is an idea. If you want to go from point A to point X, and we'll say X is all the way across the universe, there's a theory that if you could go fast enough or generate enough energy to warp or bend space-time, you could actually fold X right under A so that the distance between them is nil. But in order to do that, you would have to outrun the speed of the universe. So how about this? How about instead of speed and getting there being in terms of a linear travel, how about it being in terms of quantum entanglement travel? We have to take a break. We'll discuss that when we come back. That's what I really want to get to and see what you think about it. We'll be back, folks, right after this. We're back. My guest is physicist Chet Sapalio, who is also a novelist. And by the way, if you click on the picture of the cover of his book on my website, it will take you to the website where you can read about him. You can read an excerpt from the book and you can order the book. Okay. It is available in addition at Ingram, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and other fine bookstores everywhere. But we're talking now about his field of physics a little bit. And, you know, I'm proposing something here, an idea, and I want to get your thoughts about it. So if we forget about speed of light, just forget it, because it's only useful to us if we're going to fly from here to there in a linear fashion, and the equations are pretty linear as well. Okay, but what if the way that the ETs do it has nothing to do with speed, energy, mass? What if it has to do with quantum entanglement? So that if we think of location A as entangled with location X, then any change to A has an instantaneous change at X. And if there was some way to move from A to X using quantum entanglement, you would then be moving not at speed of light, or at FTL, faster than light, you would be moving at QS, quantum speed, and which would be instantaneous. And that would be pretty much the same thing as I've heard expressed as the speed of spirit. But what about that? Is such a notion completely impossible? Quantum entanglement as a means of travel?
Well, certainly the quantum entanglement does imply that the changes to something that was once a two particles that were once together when moved apart and a measurement is made on one, there's an instantaneous effect seen or measurement that can be taken on the other. This is true. And there was an experiment done back in the late 70s by a physicist by the name of Aspect out of France that, in fact, measured this. And the bottom line was is that it took up until that time to have the technology available, the switching devices available that were fast enough to make the measurement. And they had two particles in coherence, and then they separated the particles, and while the particles were in flight, one going in one direction, one 180 degrees in the opposite direction, while the particles were in flight, they were then able to do a switching on the measuring devices that measured them. Sort of like they didn't want to cheat and set up the measuring devices before the particles moved apart. They wanted to do it while they were moving apart. And the Aspect experiment supported exactly what you were saying, and that is that there is an instantaneous change when one is measured at a certain maybe orientation or spin, then the other reflects this first measurement instantaneously. The bottom line of the experiment is this. There are either faster than light signals that exist, which would discount special theory of relativity, or there's no objective reality in the universe, and we create reality when we do our measuring. And that tends to involve the mind. It involves the mind in creating reality. Now, both options that are available to us are a little bit mind-blowing. But that's why I love theoretical physics. You know, the experiments show that special relativity is correct. We use it in our particle accelerators every day. But on the other hand, we know that quantum entanglement exists, as you described earlier.
So, well, special relativity is correct until you go faster than the speed of light.
Well, again, I think it's a matter of definition. I think that Einstein's actual words were that you can't exceed the speed of light in this plane of existence. But if you're in an alternate state, then it's possible to do so. And by that, I'm talking about with wormhole transport, or in the case of entanglement, you know, we're talking about things that occur instantaneously. My personal belief is that we do the creating of the reality. I think that the measurement process, you know, quantum theory for your listeners, just to give them a quick background, quantum theory says that all things, all events are superimposed, that there are maybe close to an infinite number of possibilities that could occur. And these things, quantum physics also says that things are complementary, and by that, for example, something can be exhibit both particle characteristics and wave characteristics, like light, for example. Light is viewed in some theories as a wave. In optics, it's a wave. But But in the photoelectric effect, which Einstein got the Nobel Prize for, he didn't get it for relativity, but he got it for the photoelectric effect, light looks like a particle. So quantum theory says that things have these complementarity natures. It can be, they look like a wave or a particle. Well, when they look at it as a wave and they superimpose waves, that implies that you've got all of these possibilities existing. Some of your listeners might have heard of Schrodinger's cat as the cat dead or alive in the box. It's in two different states at the same time. It's not until we actually measure the state, make a measurement, make an observation, that we collapse the quantum wave to a specific experience that we have, and we call that our reality. So I believe that entanglement implies that still nothing can go faster than the speed of light. It's not information that we're sending through space-time, but rather that we're creating the reality when we make measurement. Does that compute?
Well, it does, with some exception.
Okay.
And maybe after we finish talking, there'll be no exception. Every particle in this universe, if the Big Bang theory is correct, or if anything similar to the Big Bang is correct, every particle in this universe has been in coherence with every other particle.
That's correct.
And is therefore entangled.
That's correct.
So regardless of the mechanics of how, of whether it's moving faster, whether quantum entanglement is that information is moving faster than the speed of light, or whether it is we that are creating what we observe by observing it, regardless of the mechanics, we still get the result. The result of the instantaneous reaction between the particles.
That's correct.
All right. So the question then is, instead of doing something with speed, velocity and mass in order to bend time space or fold it so that X is now right next to or under A, so that the two points are virtually touching. Instead of thinking in those terms, we can leave X where it is, leave A where it is, and figure a way to move from A to X by whatever means quantum entanglement is working. And in that way of thinking, we're not thinking of X as being away from us in a linear fashion in space. We're thinking of X as simply being another particle. It's just another place. But the distance doesn't matter if the entanglement travel is possible.
Well, the distance certainly doesn't matter if we throw time into the equation. We measure distance by using time,
mm-hmm.
And I guess, obviously that's why it's called space-time. So the quantum entanglement works as long as the particles were in coherence to begin with. There's a effect called the Casimir effect. And it introduces the concept of negative energy, which is so important in some of these alternative propulsion or advanced propulsion methods that we talk about. And the Casimir effect merely takes two conductive plates, metallic plates, places them in close proximity, and because of the energies that are always in the vacuum, and quantum theory calls for these energies, the so-called zero-point energies. You could, in fact, after you establish this setup, move one of the plates to the Andromeda galaxy. And by doing that, then set up a wormhole kind of an arrangement. So as long as the places that we're trying to go, perhaps the planets that we're trying to reach at the other end of the galaxy, were once together, and as you said, they were, if in fact Big Bang Theory is correct, then I think that your theory has potential.
Well, it's in it is theoretical, but in the real world, then there is the problem of developing a technological way to make it happen, and that, of course, would be a monumental task. But in thinking about how would extraterrestrials get here, I think some of them probably fly in a linear fashion, but I think some of them are from so far away that it is possible they're using something like what I've described, with technologies that we cannot even imagine. We have to step away for a break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Folks, don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are talking this evening with physicist and film producer, or TV producer, and novelist Chet Sapalio. Now, what I was saying, Chet, when we went away, and this leads us back to your book, there seems to be good evidence that the Earth has been and is being visited by intelligent beings from elsewhere in the universe. Now, provided that's true, we have had people on this show that have told us that there are up to 70 different species or races or civilizations of these spacefaring peoples that have visited Earth. We've had one person who was on the AlphaCom team that was formed under DARPA during the Clinton administration to gather all the evidence and prepare for disclosure. And they briefed President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore. And that guy has been on this show many times, and he says that there are 70. That's 70. So it would stand to reason some of those are more advanced than others, and some of them are from farther away than others. So the ones that are perhaps a little less advanced and close enough to do so may be flying here at the speed of light, or maybe they have found a way to use a wormhole, or maybe they found a way to travel at faster than the speed of light. But the ones from, as you said, just the stars in the universe number more than every grain of sand on every beach on the Earth. And around those stars, there are planets. Around many of those stars, there are planets, and it stands to reason that there very well could be billions of civilizations out there in the universe. at very, very far advanced levels. And it would seem that they may, some of them, have figured out how to do travel at quantum speed. That's what I'm calling it. I don't know what else to call it. But doing quantum travel as opposed to linear speed travel. And the implications of that would be they can just show up. You don't see them coming. They just show up. So you've got deep space probes out there, which we have. We have something that is called the Space-Based Space Surveillance System, and about which it was written that its purpose was to be able to identify and track forces in deep space. Okay, well, they can show up. Those things are pointed out there looking for something coming in. They can show up on this side of that system. And just boom, they're here. You don't see them coming.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, Kevin. We're talking about deep space probes that are monitoring a four-dimensional continuum, our space-time continuum. But what about the possibility of them doing dimensional shifting and just popping in from another dimension? I mean, that's another consideration. Or what if they're strictly time travelers and they're coming from our future? Or perhaps it's us coming from our own futures. These are all certainly things that used to be science fiction, good for science fiction writing and stories, now becoming science fact, things that physicists are really taking a serious look at. You mentioned the 70 possible races that your one guest had talked about when preparing for disclosure. Mm-hmm. I've always heard the number 5. Now, I'm not surprised, or certainly wouldn't be surprised. The universe is so vast, and I agree with all of your premises. There certainly could be countless intelligence races or species out there. But the 5 that I'm aware of is a group from the Pleiades, a group from the Beldegeese system, the group from Beta Reticuli, that's the Greys that everybody talks about, a star system called T. Pixidus, which has also been in the news for other reasons recently. They're talking about this star possibly going supernova. So I'm familiar with 5 of them that's in literature, but again, certainly would not be surprised if that number is far greater.
Well, obviously I don't know. I can repeat what I hear, but I'm not in possession of the files, so I don't know for sure which it is. But I would think 70 would even be a low number. But he said there were 70 that they were familiar with, and he said they had photographs of them that he was shown.
That's incredible. The real question that sort of plagues me from time to time is, and we mentioned it early on, is it just a question of the necessary energies to develop these different forms of propulsion? And most of physics is leaning that way. They claim that it takes about 10 to the 19th power, that's 10 with 19 zeros after it, electron volts, which is a measure of energy, to actually put a tear in space-time. Now, when you consider that the Hadron Collider that they just fired up again just recently over in Europe, it's the largest particle accelerator collider that we've ever created, and actually the greatest energy densities that we've ever created here on Earth. It works at the level of 10 to the 12th electron volts. So imagine 10 to the 19th being something that's a million times greater in energy capability than the Hadron Collider. That's an awful lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been my thinking, Kevin, that maybe it's not really a question of quantity, but rather a question of quality. You know, maybe these different alternative means of propulsion will be developed by the quality or the type of application of energy as opposed to the amount of it. I think that physics today is going down the road of total amounts of energy because of the Einstein field equations. You know, we've got to give credit where credit is due. Einstein certainly made some tremendous contributions, as we all know. And the Einstein field equations tell us that space-time, this four-dimensional continuum, the way that it's curved tells matter how to move. And that's what's on the left side of the equation. It tells matter how to move. And on the right side of the equation, we have matter or energy densities that tell space-time how to curve. So when you do the numbers and you do the calculations and you make the determination as the amounts of energy required to warp space-time and to make it do the kinds of things that we want it to do, you start getting into these huge, huge numbers like 10 to the 19th power, electron volts. But, you know, the general theory does, some of the solutions do in fact allow for wormholes and even time travel. And this is not just science fiction. It's a real hardcore mathematical solution to the field equations. The first solutions were developed by a gentleman by the name of Schwarzschild. And
we have to step away for break, but hold that thought, and when we come back, I want to pick up right there. Folks, we'll be back right after this. I do have the telephone numbers up on the screen, but I don't want to open the phone lines just yet because we're in the middle of some hairy theory here, and I love it. Chet, I had to cut you off in mid-speak, and I want to give you the floor here.
Okay, well, thank you, Kevin. By the way, I wanted to ask you, Kevin, with your great illustrious career, where in the world did you find the time to know or learn so much physics?
I just read a lot, Chet. I read incessantly.
Well, you do a good job of it, and you're a great conversationalist, and I like debating the theories with you.
Well, good.
I think we were talking about the solutions to the Einstein field equations that deal primarily with general relativity, and talking about how the solutions to those equations make possible the kinds of propulsion methods, the types of travel that we were discussing. I think I was explaining that Schwarzschild was the first person, Dr. Schwarzschild, that developed a solution for the field equations when he analyzed what the gravitational field would look like around a point-like star, if you can condense a star to just a point in space, what things would look like. And he developed things, terms that we've all heard of called the event horizon, which is the point of no return as you start moving towards a black hole. And he also talked about tidal forces and spaghettification, where the top of your body would be pulled less than your feet, so as you approach the black hole, you would start stretching and look like spaghetti. ultimately to be ripped apart. And then there was a professor by the name of Kerr who analyzed and found a solution to the field equations for a spinning black hole. And it's really that solution that leads us to the concept of a wormhole. But point is that they all require talking about a tremendous amount of matter and a tremendous amount of energy. I think your friend Michio Kaku classified the different types of civilizations that may be present in the universe, and he talked about a type zero intelligence, and that's where we're at here on this planet, where we utilize the energy from plants and animals. You know, we have our hydrocarbons that we use for energy. And then the type one civilization would use the energy of the entire planet. And a type two civilization would use the energy of their sun or their star. And ultimately, a type three civilization would use all the energy available in the galaxy. So if you imagine that kind of energy available to you, and you imagine a civilization that may have been around for even 1,000 years longer than we've been here, these types of propulsion methods become very, very possible.
Well, you know, I'm going to say to you something I said to Michio Kaku, and that is that I do not buy the idea that there are laws of physics. What we call laws of physics are really just descriptions of our current understanding of how things work. Because there was a time, see, one of the things that you mentioned is that all of our experiments so far have shown that Einstein's equations about relativity, general and special theory of relativity, are correct. Well, yeah, so far. But there was a time when all of the equations said Newton was right until Einstein came along. And now it's Einstein. And somebody else is going to come along and step right over Einstein. And we'll have a whole new understanding of how things work. And it's hard for us to imagine that now because we're still trying to unfold Einstein and understand all of that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And really, we are ready for that paradigm shift in physics, and it's coming. And it's being driven by the need to marry quantum theory with general relativity. And, you know, what we know is that one of the two theories are not exactly correct, or maybe they're both in need of tweaking just a little bit. But the new paradigm, the paradigm shift in physics, is due. And I hope to live to see it, and I hope to be part of it. But it is coming. And then we're going to look back at, you know, Einstein's work and put it probably in the same category that we had Newton's work. So you're absolutely right about that. Things change. And it's not laws necessarily of physics. I mean, it's a nice name that we use to categorize them, but really it depends on the particular paradigm and the level of advancement that we're at. You're so right.
You know, and there's more than one way to accomplish something. So because of Einstein and others, but with Einstein kind of as a foundation, we think in terms of speed of light, faster than light, wormholes, and so forth. And maybe that we have to go through that. It's a phase we have to go through. But, you know, I kind of look at this as, okay, there's more than one way to build a bicycle. You could build it with stone wheels and a wood frame. But if you had a little better knowledge and technology, you could build a racing bicycle. You see, and so I view our current level as sort of like building a bicycle with stone wheels in a wood frame, and I view what's coming as something that will enable us to build a true racing bicycle. And, you know, I think we've kind of got the basic concept, but in a very primitive form. Although we think it's advanced, I think it's in a very primitive form. And I think what's going to happen is speed of light's not going to be an issue for us.
Well, Kevin, just think where we've come in the last 50 years. Just think where we've gone since Einstein. And imagine, and sometimes it's really mind-boggling, but imagine where our technology is going to be in 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are intelligences in the universe that are millions or even 100 million years ahead of us, it's staggering. It's incomprehensible as to where they might be and where we might go.
Imagine what it would be like if quantum travel were possible. We wouldn't have to think about these enormous amounts of energy. If quantum travel were possible, and I have another little theory. It's really a philosophy, and that is, if you can imagine it, then it does exist. Maybe we don't know how to build it yet, but it's a possibility. If you can imagine it, it can be done.
Well, it's going back to creating our own reality, you know?
Well, if quantum travel were possible, then we could instantaneously be anywhere we wanted to be.
Wouldn't that be sweet?
Well, I don't know. If you miscalculated where you wanted to be, you might wind up in the middle of somebody's star, and that could be a little painful.
That could be tough.
Yeah.
You know. Again, I'm not sure that, as you said, it's the quantity of energy, or if it's the quality of energy and how it's applied, or maybe it's all being done with our mind. But you know, the evidence, and I was fortunate enough to talk with four of the actual participants in the Roswell event, and the one gentleman that was involved in the recovery of the craft said that they found no evidence of a propulsion system on board the craft, or at least anything that they could readily identify as the propulsion system.
Well, see, and I knew that, and that is what led me down this path of discussion with you. Is then, if there's no propulsion system, it must be something along the lines of some kind of I think it and it happens. Kind of, you know, I think, therefore I am. I think it and there I am.
Yes.
Which would be some type of quantum travel. So, you know, I've heard other people say that they have worked on craft, trying to back engineer them and so forth, reverse engineer them, and that they could not find the propulsion system. But then there are others who say they have worked on reverse engineering, for instance, Bob Lazar, who described a propulsion system. So that leads me to think that some of these folks that are coming here are using technology that to us is very advanced, but in the greater universe may be primitive.
Yes, indeed. Like you said, if there's, you know, multiple intelligences visiting, then I'm sure that they're on the same treadmill that we're on, and some of them are much more advanced than others. So I'm sure there's a real variety of propulsion methods out there.
The person that you interviewed who worked with the recovery, did this person say that they found any bodies?
The claim that this gentleman made was that they recovered 5 humanoid-type bodies, ashen in color, fair skin. But he said that, and I'm quoting him now, he said they were pretty people. They weren't ugly people. They weren't. I think he called them horny toads. He said that they were pleasant to look at, very well built, seemed like they were very in shape, so to speak, but short, somewhere in the neighborhood of 4.5 feet tall, larger than normal heads and eyes. similar somewhat to the things that we see today in the drawings and depictions, but he said that they weren't hard to look at, is exactly how he said it.
I've heard that the clothing that they were wearing seemed to be almost like part of their body, that it was sort of an integral part of their body, and you couldn't just take their clothes off.
This gentleman talked about them seeming like jumpsuits, metallic fabric in nature, or sort of a cloth metal weave is what he told me. He also talked a little bit about the getting back to our concept of mind control, or mind creating reality. He said that the navigation system was a mental or a mind interface with whatever was the propulsion method.
All right, now, you were talking about kind of a metallic fabric, and that made me wonder, because as an international police officer, I have worked in some really, really, really cold places, and some that were extremely hot on the other end of the scale. But in the really, really, really cold places, I had something that it's called undersocks. Now these, at least the advertisements for them say that it's a NASA creation, but they're shiny metallic looking socks, and you wear them under your socks, and I can promise you, no matter how cold it is outside, your feet will not get cold if you wear these. They're extremely thin. I mean, almost as thin as a lady's stocking.
Yes.
But they're very shiny metallic socks that you wear under your regular socks. I wonder if that's back engineered from this material that they found on these humanoids.
Well, you know, what we've discovered with that type of reflective material is that what's happening is that they're preserving the body heat by reflecting the heat back. And it's not conductive or convective heat that we're talking about, but rather radiant heat. And a metallic material is the ticket for accomplishing that. Yeah, and you know, I'm sure that there have been many things back engineered from the discoveries of the crashed saucers or UFOs. The story is also that night vision goggles were developed. Also, you know, there was a great jump in computer technology. The transistor was developed immediately after the Roswell incident. You know, I'm sure that there's a lot that they're still attempting to understand and back engineer. It just confirms even more for me the fact that what Blanchard and his team recovered on the Foster Ranch was certainly not a weather balloon.
Yeah, I think the weather balloon story is about as feasible these days as the swamp gas story.
Well, exactly, and it is just incredible to me that the powers to be have changed their story three times about what in fact was recovered at Roswell. It was first a weather balloon, and then a Raywin target, and finally it was Project Mogul. And the dropping of anthropomorphic dummies, which in fact were dropped in 1952 and not in 1947. So, you know, somebody knows a whole lot more than we do. And boy, I would really like to know the entire truth.
I would. And let me ask you your opinion on something. Why do you think they've got this under such wraps.
Well, I think, you know, and I know that we don't want to get political here, but I think that there's issues with appearance. For example, if the government were to come out and tell us that they are in fact not in control of our airspace, and that flying objects could come and go at will, and we had nothing that we could do about it, I think that they would lose a little bit of so-called face and respect by the general public. I think that's one concern.
I also, well, 911 proved they're not controlling the airspace.
Yeah, isn't that the truth?
Mm-hmm.
I also think that there's a concern over economic collapse. Mm-hmm. I think that there are energy technologies that have trickled down from the back engineering that may, in fact, take the number one industry in the world, the energy oil industry slash oil industry, mm-hmm. and put it out of business. You know, our entire economic superstructure would be gone. Our banking systems, it really might become quite chaotic. So it's a question of, you know, do they take the chance? Do they move into these changes gradually? Do they take the chance of you know, economic collapse and things couldn't get a whole lot worse than they are now? Or do they spoon feed us a little bit of information, you know, and take another, 50-100 years in order to disclose the full truth? I just really don't know. I hope it comes sooner than later.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen whether they want it to or not, actually. I want to open up the telephone lines and invite our audience to join us. And if you have questions or comments, we would be more than happy to entertain your questions or comments. And you can get in touch with us by calling our main number here in the studio from anywhere in the world. This number will work. 623-444-5889. Now, if you're calling from outside of the United States, our country code is 1. So it would be 1-623-444-5889. If you're in the U.S. or Canada, we do have a toll-free number. If you cannot call me without it costing you long distance, call me on the toll-free number, 888-223-4599. If you are not in the USA, you're not in Canada, and you don't want to make that international long-distance call, you can go to my website, scroll down, and you will see a link that says Flash Message, and you'll also see it says if you're not in the USA and you're not in Canada, okay? If you're in the USA or Canada, use the phones. I will even pay for the call if you need me to, all right? Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, it's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario.
Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Kevin. Hello there, chat.
Good evening.
Good evening. Yeah, you were talking about the extraterrestrial presence on this planet, that there were some from many different places, and I can understand Sirius and Orion, as well as Zeta Reticuli. Those particular stars have been with us for millennia. Since the dawning of time, when do you suppose that on a mass scale that the existence of these non-Earth intelligences, whom I think are just as human as we are, when do you think it's going to be undeniable that these things exist, that even the most ardent skeptic is not going to be able to deny it? When do you think that's going to happen?
Well, Kevin, that's an excellent question, and I really wish I could give you an absolute date when that's going to occur, but I can tell you that the majority of the polled population, at least in the United States, and I believe the same is the case in China, France, and probably Russia, the majority, and upwards to close to 70%, so it's a rather large majority, already believes that it's fact. They accept it as reality. When that number becomes 100%, boy, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's going to take a lot to convince a lot of people, especially those if you follow a Project Paperclip and also Project Bluebeam. You know, I think nowadays it may take a lot for them to convince everybody that yes, there is an off-world intelligence that does exist. You know, and
let me interject something. What does it matter if everyone is convinced?
Well, you know, I guess it's for an undeniable thing. So we can't have any debunkers trying to make, you know.
Listen, there's going to be debunkers forever. There are probably people out there still trying to prove the Earth is flat.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really doesn't. I don't know. Kevin, you know my opinion on this. If something is real, it doesn't matter whether somebody believes it or not. It's still going to stand there and be real. And, you know, they can believe it's not, but, I mean, that's kind of like saying I don't believe in gravity. But if you walk off the edge of a 40-story building, whether you believe or not, it's going to impress itself on you. All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And my guest this evening, Chet Sapalio. He is a TV producer, he is a physicist, he's a philosopher, and he is a novelist. And he is absolutely thoroughly interesting to talk with. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. You know, I got mostly just a statement for you and your guest. You know, just I think the problem is it just goes back to the days of Tesla. You know, if he got a hold of the right people and we took him seriously, I mean, God, could you imagine what kind of world and how far advanced we would be at this point in time. And also, I think, you know, everyone's worried about, you know, zero-point energy, you know, and how it's going to crash, you know, the economy and stuff because going off of oil. But I think it'll do just the opposite. I mean, just imagine, everything is going to have to be first, you're going to have to make billions of these things. You're going to have to make them in billions of sizes because everything that runs on electric and AC is going to have to be probably will be powered by one of these things. You know, these factories are going to have to make all this stuff. You know, we're going to have to get rid of all the garbage that, you know, we did use by electricity that's no longer needed. You know, take down all the telephone poles. I mean, there's going to be so many jobs switching over to this that I believe it'll be more a shot in the arm than...
Well, if you switch over, if you have a transition period, if you do it suddenly and you collapse all the economies, it's Mad Max time.
Yeah, well, you know, it's going to take a while to build them all, you know, and for people to buy them and to put them in their houses. I mean, it's going to be a gradual situation. I mean, they're not going to be able to make, you know, billions of these things in a short period of time. And, you know, and I think the real reason why it's not happening is the simple fact that the Bilderbergs or the money-hungry people don't want it to happen. Just for the almighty buck. You know, they don't want us to have that kind of freedom. But I think it wouldn't crash the economy. You know, we'd still need oil, even if we did have, even if it did happen pretty fast, there would still be enough need for oil that it wouldn't crash the economy. I don't believe.
Okay.
I think he makes a really good point. I certainly agree with your applause and accolades that you give Tesla. He was a great mind. And I think a whole lot of his thinking and theories and inventions were suppressed, probably for the same reason that they're suppressing alternative energies today. And I would hope that that transition that you're so positively invoking takes place. I think it's going to take some time, though.
Terry, thanks for the call. I have a flash message from Sam in the United Kingdom. Very interesting flash message. He says, "Hi, Kevin, if you went faster than the speed of light, wouldn't you catch up with older light? In other words, travel backwards in time rather than find yourself in darkness." Well, that depends on whether you think of light as linear. And I don't. I think it's spherical. And so I think all light is happening at all times concurrently, past, present, and future, spherically. But, you know, who am I? All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. This is Ryan.
Hi, Ryan.
Well, I was just going to listen. Then you started talking about these debunkers, and a UFO could land on Phil Plait's lap, and he'd still say that it was just Venus.
There are always going to be some.
The bad astronomer, Phil Plait. Anyways, I'll just ask one question then hang up.
All right.
I was wondering about your guest. What part of the country are you located in? What are you going to be doing, or how do we get your book? And what do you do when you're not writing? Are you involved in any other things that like if somebody wanted to get in touch with you? Or
yeah, Ryan, thank you for asking. I spend a lot of time doing theoretical physics, and I think I spend a lot of time trying to work through the problem of anti-gravity. I mean, that's the thing that juices me up and makes me go every day. I'm located in southwestern Pennsylvania, and, you know, go to the website. That's where you can hook up with the book, www.sworntosecrecy-roswell.com. Send me an email, and I'd be more than happy to communicate with you and listen to some of your ideas.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for the call. Carl from Australia has sent a flash message. He's in Perth. He says, "I can think of one way that entanglement may be employed for near instantaneous travel from star system to star system. However, there's a catch. The catch is you have to put the places in place first, which may take a long time. However, after the investment in time and effort, entanglement may give you a doorway." And then he goes on. It's pretty long. He talks about von Neumann probes or a device that had to travel through space at near light speed and so forth. Well, see, with entanglement, you don't have to put the places in place. It doesn't matter where the particles are. If they've ever been in coherence with your particle, which if the Big Bang theory is true, all particles have been in coherence. So if it's ever been in coherence, it wouldn't matter where it is. You don't have to put them in place in order for entanglement to be a reality. Am I right, Chet?
Yes, you are. You know, assuming that all the particles in the universe came from the same Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the only loophole there. I think what the gentleman might be talking about is what I had referred to earlier on with the Casimir effect, where you recognize the effect and you create the negative energy and the wormhole effect, but you move the plates apart. And once they're apart, once you take the one to Andromeda and you leave the one here, then you can jump into the wormhole and it works. But yeah, you know, if from the beginning, if things were in coherence, then they're forever in coherence, just as you said.
All right, to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is James from Texas.
Hi, James.
Good evening, James.
Hello, Mr. Sipaglio. Mr. Sipaglio, I have some questions for you. As a theoreticist, to your mind, what are the elements or components or factors that comprise a planet's gravity?
Well, I think the gravity is the curvature of space-time. Now, the graviton, you know, the quantum theory says that there's probably an accompanying particle with every force, and I'm not sure that that's the case or not with gravity, and certainly we haven't yet detected gravitational waves, however the experiments are in place to do that, nor have we detected gravitons. But what I do know for sure, and I take this from the general relativity theory, is that the true definition of gravity is not that it's so much a force as it is bent or curved space-time. It's the curvature of space-time.
Suppose that I could give you a consideration that allows for another component that isn't being utilized in thought today.
I would be excited to hear about that, James.
It deals with helium. You know that helium cannot be held to Earth. Is that right?
Helium cannot be held to Earth?
No.
Well, are you talking about its buoyancy as a gas and it being lighter than the atmosphere?
I'm talking about it cannot be held to Earth. When it escapes any container, it goes into space.
Okay. So you're not talking about a super cooled state or another state of matter. You're talking about the buoyancy of helium?
You're talking about liquid helium. The same is true of liquid helium. It'll turn to a gas when exposed to the atmosphere, and it'll escape into space.
I'm sure of that, yeah.
All right. If that's true, and you know that the moon has greater mass density than the Earth, what holds it to the moon that does not hold it to Earth?
Are you referring to the fact that there's helium-3 on the moon?
There's helium on the moon. There's no isotope of helium. It cannot have an isotope.
James?
Yes.
I think that helium-3 is, in fact, an isotope of helium, but I'm more curious to find out how you know that helium is held on the moon and does not escape.
The Japanese wanted to launch an expedition to helium to the moon to extract what they were calling helium-3. Helium is known to exist on the moon.
So it's captured within the solids of the moon, the rocks?
No. There's no mineral of helium. What you've been told about there being deposits, natural deposits on Earth, is a lie. Helium only exists when on Earth, only exists for a fragmentary time when it comes out of a reaction as oil is converted to gas. And unless collected, will go into space.
Well, James, that's interesting. Can you share with me, please, where I might get some more information on that?
Certainly.
James, why don't you do this? If you click on the picture of his book on my website, if you click on that, it will take you to the site that he mentioned that's about his book, and there's a contact page there. And you can use that and tell him where he can get more information about this.
Well, before I go, can I explain to him why there is so much misgivings and misinformation about helium?
Well, I would let you, except we're 3 seconds away from break. In fact, it just took over.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. All right. We have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. Pardon me if you heard me cough. I usually get to the microphone kill switch before I cough, but I just didn't reach it in time. Oh, well, such is life. We're talking with Chet Sapalio, and wow, what a conversation we're having with Chet Sapalio. We're on Final Approach. We have time for one or two more calls. The telephone lines are open, 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. If you need to call me toll-free, use the 888 number. If you can call me without it costing you long distance, please use the 623 number. And we have, as I say, time for one, maybe two more calls. Just for your information, I know a lot of you have been trying to get in. 31 of you so far have tried and couldn't get in because that's what happens on a popular show. You just have to keep trying. But I want to thank every one of you who has tried. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, gentlemen. It's Brian from Burnaby. Great show tonight. Love the physics topic. And I was just wondering, string theory's been around for 20-odd years now, and according to a program I heard about a month ago, it said there's no actual physical experiment that can either prove or disprove string theory. Now, they didn't sort of give a coherent explanation, you know, why it's been around so long, and yet it explains everything so beautifully as far as, you know, the electrons and the forces and neutrons and such, and still there's no experiment that can prove or disprove it.
Chet, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, Brian, you know, as a matter of fact, I have some things here in my notes about string theory, but I don't think I mentioned string theory at all. However, you're absolutely right. String theory is a beautiful mathematical construct, but from a hard science perspective, I don't really believe that it's a testable theory. And in order for it to be real science, you know, we need to test the theory. I'm a proponent. I study quantum gravity, and certainly string theory is one approach to quantum gravity to marry the two topics. But I am more of a loop quantum gravity type person. But I would certainly be interested if you could come up with some method to actually test string theory, because it certainly is a beautiful mathematical entity.
Yes, well thanks. It just seems it's been around for so long now, and it would seem that it even needs an explanation of why no one has come up in this time that... If it explains everything so well, yet nothing can be thought of by all these high-powered people thinking about these things to come up with either a falsify or confirm something in the theory.
Well, think about Einstein's theories of relativity, both general and special. We are only just now coming up with the technologies to be able to test certain aspects of that to see if it's real. And it's been around longer than string theory.
Yeah, that's certainly a good point.
So, you know, just because we don't have the tests available now for string theory doesn't mean that those tests will not be forthcoming. As technology advances, perhaps it will become possible to test it.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
All right. Thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, there are certain aspects of I believe it's the special theory of relativity that are just now beginning to be tested with some satellites.
Yeah, in fact, it's the general theory, I think, that you speak of.
Oh, the general theory, okay.
Yeah, and it's brand new technology, very promising technology. Just as they're looking for gravitational waves, trying to find waves that might be generated by perhaps two pulsars that are binary pulsars that are spinning around each other. And as they get closer and closer together, that rotational energy is converted to gravitational energy, and then that gravitational energy is transmitted through the universe. And we have detectors now in place to hopefully detect them, and hopefully something like that will happen soon.
Now, we've only got just a very few minutes here, and we'll hit the brick wall at the end of the show. How much of your background, and with what we've talked about here tonight, we certainly know that you have quite a background in physics, but how much of that played into the novel?
Quite a bit. I particularly, you know, you talk about my background in philosophy. I'm a philosopher of science. And I really tried to reflect some of that sentiment in the book, and talking about the disposition of the world, the battles established by these military industrial complexes, the fact that wouldn't it be nice if we could live in peace and harmony. We could take all of those budgeted dollars for defense and turn it into pure scientific research. So a portion of the book is devoted to my sentiments, and there is a message there for the readers.
If we were to take, say, one-tenth of what we spent on Iraq and Afghanistan, and, say, give it to NASA, just a tenth of it, I wonder what there would be about the universe they might be able to discover with that.
Well, you know, money talks and very little happens without it. And with that kind of dollars focused on the effort, I'm sure that we'd make tremendous discoveries. I'm really concerned with the recent concept of taking dollars away from NASA and taking away the astronauts and so on and putting it in the hands of private industry, actually a little frustrated by that. So, I think that it's a pipe dream to consider taking even just a tenth of that budget and putting it into pure research. But let's hope that that happens down the road.
I don't know. I'm very unkind about some of the things that I've seen happen. When I say unkind, I'm that's not true. I'm politically not correct because I tell the truth about it. You know, if you got $1 trillion or right at $1 trillion that you can throw at AIG and GM and Citibank and everybody else that got some of that money, you know. And you quibble about $18 billion a year going to NASA? You know, there's something seriously insane happening in Washington.
Yeah,
that's not politics. That's just an issue. That would be an issue whether there was a politician living or not.
Yeah, Kevin, it's a sad state of affairs, and it makes me, not think twice about maybe intelligent civilizations visiting the Earth and not necessarily wanting to make total contact with us. We sometimes are a disappointing species, aren't we?
We certainly are to me. And I think we would be. I think we would just be bizarre to an advanced species. They'd look at us and just, it'd be like going to a circus. We're just bizarre. Chet, I want to thank you for being with us. And if you will, stay on the line with me for a moment as we close the show, because I want to talk with you for a moment after the show.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. You're a great host, a great conversationalist, and certainly a true professional. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you and your listeners.
All right. Thank you. Folks, the name of the book is Sworn to Secrecy, the 1947 Roswell incident. And you can click on my website there, the picture of the book, and it'll take you to the site. It's been fascinating, hasn't it? But it always is. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.